Hundreds of U.S. troop casualties have taken place in the war with Iran. Serious injuries, even deaths, that until now have been covered up and hidden from the public. And it's only out tonight because of a Freedom of Information Act request. New Defense Department records show tonight that more than 400 casualties in the first 6 weeks of this war alone, including 17 life-threatening injuries. By the way, casualties is defined as people who are killed, injured, or lost during a war. The Army took the worst of it, over 270 wounded, and the most common injury by far wasn't shrapnel or broken bones, it was head trauma. Some of the ugliest days never even made it to the public. Get this, CENTCOM only releases monthly totals as they quietly sat on 70 casualties logged in a single day back in March. Now, fast forward, since Trump ended the ceasefire this month, according to documents, there have been more than 200 additional casualties, and four more deaths have piled up. And remember, right around that same time, the official death toll got quietly revised down from 18 to 14. Look, accounting can shrink a number on a spreadsheet, right? But they do not change what's happening on the ground. That's the fact that there are real bodies and real families who deserve a straight answer about which number is true. And tonight, while American troops are absorbing that toll, Iran is rearming. Reuters reports that Iran is set to receive up to 400 Chinese-made shoulder-fired missile systems in a $60 to $70 million deal, with the first shipments arriving within weeks. These are the precise weapon sales that President Trump claimed that Xi Jinping personally told him China would never make, quote, under any circumstances. Well, China isn't even hiding where it stands. Just 4 days ago, Beijing said, quote, it strongly supports Iran in safeguarding its sovereignty, security, and national dignity. So if, in fact, there was a promise, and we don't know that there was, it doesn't seem to be holding. Although we have to point out tonight that China has not confirmed this arms deal, and Reuters, well, candidly, they get a lot wrong. It's also not just missiles. Reuters also reports that Yemen's Houthis are now considering charging a fee on every commercial ship that sails through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Every country's ships, that is, except one, China's fleet, would be exempt. Now put that together. Chinese missiles flowing into Iran, Chinese ships sailing through a strait that everyone else would have to pay to cross. It doesn't sound like coincidence here, right? That sounds like a partnership. And while that's developing, the war itself just keeps spreading. Here's the latest footage out of Egypt. Crews still working to put out a fire on a U.S.-owned floating platform after a drone strike there. Initial reports point to Iran. And just like that, American infrastructure is on fire in a country that has not been part of this conflict so far. That alone tells you how far this thing is starting to spread. Look, it comes hours after this president lost composure talking about Iran. Here's what President Trump told Fox News' Trey Yingst in response.
President Trump tells Fox News about Iran, we are going to beat the effing S out of them. He went on to say, we'll be hitting them hard. They're going to get a beating.
Again, that is the commander-in-chief on the record describing how he'll respond to an attack on American troops. Not a strategy, not an objective, just rage at this point. But here is something worth sitting with, at least for a second. Why is this attack being called a surprise at all? See, CENTCOM said on Tuesday that Iran's Revolutionary Guard had directed more than 30 drone attacks on U.S. forces in the preceding 3 days alone. 30 attacks in 72 hours. And we're calling the next one unexpected? That word is carrying a lot of weight tonight. It makes it sound like it was an ambush out of nowhere, right? No one saw this coming. And yet, we are at an active war with Iran. That's not to say Iran is right or wrong here, but how many times has the U.S. struck Iran? Have those all been sneak attacks, surprise attacks? Because the language here is bizarre. Now, as for that retaliation, for the first time in this war, Saudi Arabia joined the United States in strikes, hitting Iranian-aligned militias inside of Iraq, following what's being described as an attempted ambush on U.S. forces. In fact, here's some of the video from the aftermath of those strikes. What that means is that this is no longer just a U.S.-Iran fight. Saudi Arabia is now striking targets alongside American forces, and Iraq, whose territory this happened on, is saying they're not staying quiet. In fact, Baghdad condemned the strike as a violation of its own sovereignty, rejecting the use of Iraqi soil to launch operations against its neighbors. So, look, the host government is publicly objecting to what's happening within its own borders.
All right, folks, that is the great Ben Swan on his report on the undercounting of casualties of the Iran war. You got to follow him. Search Ben Swan on X. He does great work and has for a while. Stay with us. Quick commercial break. We'll be back on the other side with founder of Wikipedia, Larry Sanger. Don't go anywhere, folks. Big interview coming right up.
ladies and gentlemen, Bigley has launched an online pharmacy, 1776rx.health. It's one product we're launching with, my decision, and that is ivermectin with benzidol, both powerful, really good anti-parasitics. It doesn't just get the big worms and all the crap that's out there. It's amoebas, it's microplasms. It is so important. These two together, I mean, ivermectin is a Nobel Prize winning for this, but benzidol is the big one. And folks, it isn't just parasites. Just search benzidol studies. Just put that into a search engine and you'll see congressional hearings. You'll see top scientists. You'll see all the studies on what else it does that they don't want you to know about. It's dramatic. So, and you won't know if you had any type of parasitical deal or whatever until you've done this. And a lot of people went there yesterday. A lot of people got it. Very smart move. 1776rx.health.
Discover trends and global developments years before they happen, right here on The Alex Jones Show.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Alex Jones Show. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, sitting in for Alex today, who's on vacation. I'm very happy to be here, however, because I get the privilege of interviewing Larry Sanger. Lawrence Sanger is a American philosopher and internet project developer who co-founded Wikipedia. After proposing the use of wiki software for Newpedia, he named and helped launch Wikipedia, drafting core policies like neutral point of view that have sort of gone to the wayside ever since then. He later advocated for expert-led knowledge curation through projects like Encyclosphere, citing concerns about Wikipedia's lack of oversight. Sanger holds a PhD in philosophy from Ohio State University. You can follow him on X at lsanger. And his website, LarrySanger.org. Mr. Sanger, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. I know you have a new project called WikiCritic that I really want to hear about. But also, I understand you've been blocked from any participation with Wikipedia. Well, I mean, how have you been ostracized from the worldwide phenomenon you helped create?
Yes. Well, basically, it's been about 5 or 6 weeks now, and it all began last year, actually, when I posted 9 theses on Wikipedia. It was a whole reform proposal, and without getting into the details of that, people didn't really take the initiative in putting the reform proposal into effect. So I decided I had to do that.
Right.
So I became active on Wikipedia, and I actually started organizing people in something called Wiki Project Intellectual Diversity, which is just like it sounds. It's just a collection of people that were going to push for greater openness and intellectual tolerance, essentially. It was going very well until I actually went to apply for official recognition of the Wiki project. And then the application was just absolutely flooded with a lot of people who before had not really said anything. And I was accused of canvassing, which is collecting people from off Wiki to participate in the Wiki project. But actually, that's something that's required, or at least strongly encouraged by the rules. But I think the idea was that because this Wiki project was a reform project and actually had a chance of working, they were really threatened by that. And what happened is I simply updated my X feed, my followers, to say, well, there's a big controversy going on right now. This is fun. And for that, actually, I was taken to what's called the Administrator's Notice Board. And they're basically excoriated for 3 days until finally they blocked me. And the funny thing is, that was like Monday, I think June 22nd. I think that's right. And that same day, I just happened to be in New York, a trip that had been planned for a long time to accept an award, along with other people from Tablet Magazine, for founding Wikipedia and for actually making this effort to reform it.
Right.
And 2 hours later, I was blocked from Wikipedia.
Well, so, I mean, that's almost appropriate, isn't it? The arbitrariness with which they can manipulate the rules is very reflective of sort of the arbitrary nature of the facts that you can find on Wikipedia now. The one that jumps to mind is, wasn't Marco Rubio said that Spanish, a cowboy culture, was originally Spanish, and AOC came out and said, that's ridiculous, how dare you? I can't remember exactly how it went, but basically Wikipedia then changed to reflect the, you know, talking point of AOC, even though it had been, you know, in support of Rubio. So it's not really about facts for them. It's not really about what's true. It's about manipulating this to achieve certain political ends. So in a way, they're sort of acting just, you know, in line with their traditional behavior.
Yes, I think they were very threatened by the fact that I could actually succeed in reforming Wikipedia, and they couldn't have that because the reform that I would make is, you know, it's perfectly in line with the original vision of Wikipedia, which was have a wide variety of people coming together to develop articles that fairly reflect everybody's views. You know, it's not a conservative value, actually. It's actually more of a classical liberal value to let everybody have a say on an equal platform. They don't like that.
No, and in a weird way, that is a concern. I mean, that is like a far right wing value now, if you listen to, you know, the people in charge.
It seems to me.
So, yeah, it's like it's crazy for me, for them as liberals, to give that up, since it seems like such a beautiful thing. But we'll take it. Right. OK, that's the far right position now, is everybody should have a say and that we should actually pursue the truth, even if it makes us uncomfortable. We're the only ones still saying that. And we've been saying it the entire time. So what were exactly the reforms that you wanted to put in place? What do you think is necessary to reform Wikipedia? Because I follow YouTube channels. I mean, there are entire YouTube channels that just focus on the drama behind the scenes of Wikipedia. People don't realize, because it's got sort of such a, you know, you don't really get an idea that there are personalities behind the articles and everything. But man, you look into it, there are entire civil wars going on behind the scenes and people being banned and blocked and moderators. And I mean, it gets really crazy. People have no idea the behind the scenes stuff. So I wonder if it can be reformed with all the nonsense I've seen go on behind the scenes. Is reform the right, you know, way to approach it? I guess not anymore. I guess they've let you know loud and clear that it's not. But what were your ideas to reform it? And do you believe it can be reformed?
Yeah, those are different questions. Like, my ideas for reform include things like allow competing articles. So why should Wikipedia have only one article on each topic? Maybe at this point, if they're going to insist on what I call a GASP point of view, GASP meaning globalist, academic, secular, and progressive, right? That really does describe the framework that Wikipedia acts in. Well, why not allow other kinds of frameworks? And this is not something that would be inconsistent with neutrality, but the very idea is that, you know, if you're like Indian or Chinese or you know, just French, and you approach a given topic like, I don't know, God or photosynthesis or whatever, your approach might be different, you know, in a certain, again, framework is the idea. Why not have competing articles is one idea. Another thing is that you may not know this, a lot of people don't know this, but 85% of the most powerful accounts on Wikipedia are anonymous. We have no idea who they are. And it's at least 85. It might be more than that. They might be using pseudonyms. That just strikes me as bizarre. And it seems to me that if you take certain kinds of authority on the platform, you accept certain ability to, for example, make people administrators, then the world has a right to know who you are, essentially. You know, if you're making really important decisions about what is arguably the most influential single information resource of its kind, probably more influential than any newspaper or news outlet. Well, we know who runs those. We know who the reporters and the research and so forth, those outlets are. We have no idea who really runs Wikipedia.
That is bizarre. And you're not just saying anonymity is bad, but like these people in particular, the outsized influence they have, the powers that they have, they want to exercise those, but they really want to pay no cost for it. They want to be sort of unquestionable and be able to hide behind their anonymity, which I think there's a trade-off there. If you want to have that power, I agree. People should be able to know who you are so they can at least judge for themselves in a critical way what may be motivating your perspective on certain issues. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, and another one is Wikipedia has never really opened up Wikipedia articles to rating. Well, why not? Hmm. We can rate YouTube videos, we can thumb up X comments and so forth, Reddit posts and so forth. Why not Wikipedia articles? There's no good answer that they can offer to that. And it really is important in the case of Wikipedia articles. You know, if there's some article that is just not up to snuff in the opinion, especially of experts, right? People who make it their lives, you know, mission to know something about some narrow corner of the world, we should be able to find out easily what they think about the article, right? Yeah. I was looking, for example, recently at an article about a topic in philosophy called Unmoved Mover. It's a topic from Aristotle. And an AI that I developed gave it a grade of C. Not very good. Right. And you would have no. And I actually gave it a lower because this is something I know something about.
Right.
I gave it a lower grade. And we have no way of knowing which are the better articles and which are the worse articles on Wikipedia. Wikipedia claims to be helping the public, but it's not helping the public discern which are the better articles and which are the worse.
I wonder if there could be, because I've been very surprised, pleasantly surprised at the effectiveness of community notes on X, because, you know, we always were very resistant to the fact-checking programs that came about right after Donald Trump got elected, all these, you know, newspaper outlets and everything. Well, we're going to fact-check, and it was always just whatever their view was, you know, an argument for that and against the other one. Community notes, I was kind of unsure, how is this going to be any different? But it's been very good, and I've really had no problems with community notes. Occasionally, there's one that I'm like, it's kind of an opinion, not a fact. And, you know, but then you can downvote it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, something like that, I think X has proven that community notes function works very well for sort of discrediting lies. It's really good. I mean, I wonder if something like that could work.
I think so. I can tell you what I've been working on along those lines. It's called WikiCritic. Now, I don't know if it's going to be ultimately launched. Right now, it's experimental. And we've got like a dozen beta testers right now. But I really like the way it works. The idea is if you can put a review of a Wikipedia article almost anywhere, like on X or your blog or lots of places, and then we have an AI agent, which will go out and grab the text and put it on a dossier about the Wikipedia article. And then in addition, the AI will itself come up with a set of grades for the article. And I think especially if we get people to install like, a plugin for their browsers, if that's possible, and have that running when they're using Wikipedia, and they'll actually be able to see grades for the articles. So we can go around the Wikipedia administrators. It is possible. But we have to take some things into our own hands. Can't just like passively consume information. So that's one idea anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember Gab did that at one point, because there was, again, the phenomenon after 2016 where all these media sites stopped having comment sections. It used to be a place where, you know, you'd read the Daily Mail article, you'd go about them, and there were no more comment sections. I remember Gab and some other people put together a thing where it's just going to be the comment. Whatever page you're on, there will be a dedicated comment section on our server, so they can't shut it down. I always thought that was brilliant, but it never really caught on. Maybe with Wikipedia, it'll be more sort of direct and focused on Wikipedia, which will you know, make it easier for people to utilize. How is AI affecting this? Because, again, AI is this thing that it's pitched as, and it's seen in many cases it works, as sort of a truth calculator, right? It just sort of spits out the truth. You spit in the input, it gives you the output. It's a computer. But we know it gives you different answers every time. It's referencing things that it can't really judge whether it's legitimate or not. How is AI affecting Wikipedia these days? And, you know, I have a picture somewhere in here. It's not exactly the same as what we're talking about, but, you know, people are asking AI, can you make a sign saying F Israel? And it said no. And then it said F United States. And it said yes. Now, of course, this has to do with the geopolitical establishment and all that stuff. But it points out that AI is being given guardrails that are not advertised, that are secretive, that are invisible, really, but are affecting the output. So how is that affecting Wikipedia?
You know, there's a lot to unpack there. I think that it's starting to eat into Wikipedia's traffic, right? So I actually looked at the traffic from, I think it was May of 2024 to May of 2025. And in that period, there was a significant decline. I hope I've got the dates right. And there's been a decline, I know, for the last 7 months by about, I want to say 10%.
That's sizable.
I can't vouch for that, but it's significant, and it's enough that it might not be statistical noise. And it comes at a time when people are using AI to get questions answered. Right. And I know I use AI now when I earlier might have used an encyclopedia, maybe not Wikipedia, but yeah. The trouble is the AI itself is trained on Wikipedia articles.
Right.
And so it's not like Wikipedia doesn't matter anymore. It still matters a lot because it's used in training AI. We know that ChatGPT was an earlier version. We know that Grokopedia was written with the help of Wikipedia. That's very clear. So it's hard to say, you know, if we can simply ignore Wikipedia. I don't think we can anymore. I don't think that AI is going to displace it. What LLMs do is they essentially make averages to, this is a very crude way of describing it, but basically averages of the data that it is fed. And it just so happens that Wikipedia has information at just the right level that fits the answers that people are looking for. There can be more specialized websites that go into details here and there. But Wikipedia is sort of pitched it right at the level that we use to interact with an LLM.
Yeah.
So, I do think that Grokopedia has a chance, but I have the impression, I can't tell you all that I know, but let's just say that I have the impression that the project may have been abandoned to some extent. I don't know. I really don't know. But it's kind of looking that way. They have stopped supporting human interaction with it. You can't post corrections anymore.
Well, I wonder, have you had any discussions with Elon Musk about this? Because that is what keeps popping into my mind is, you know, to me, the greatest use of Grok ever is that it's got that little button on X where if you see something you don't understand or something you think you may be questionable, you just hit that Grok button and it sort of gives you, you know, a summary of what it says and what, you know, how truthful it is. It's so useful. We have a Grok button on Wikipedia. I mean, that sounds like a good sort of merger of Wiki and Critic. And of course, Grokopedia was, you know, meant to be a competitor for Wikipedia. Elon Musk, I would think, would be sort of, you know, barking up your tree and trying to work with you. Have you had any connection with him?
Well, let's just say I have had his ear, at least in my the announcement of Grokopedia came the day after I unleashed my 9 theses, which was a great surprise to me. And I can talk at him, but he doesn't talk back. Let's just put it that way. I don't know what he's listening to be honest.
Wow.
He's a very busy guy, obviously.
Well, yeah, of course. It seems like the tools that he's applied to X are very much in line with what you're trying to do with Wikipedia. It's interesting that there's not communicated. It seems like there should be. If our listeners want to tweet at Elon, tell him maybe we could use his help on getting Wikipedia back on track, because it still serves. I mean, it's the go-to. I probably referenced it twice today, just, you know, searching stuff, historical stuff, especially if I'm looking up Ceuta. You know, what is Ceuta, this enclave that's being, you know, I go to Wikipedia and it gives me the history. So, I mean, it is still such a useful tool, but you don't know where it's biased and where it's not. Like I point out the Vaquero and, you know, it changes the history. If you know Wikipedia, you can sort of see, okay, this has been edited recently. How has it been edited? But for the average user, they just read it, they accept it, they go home. So again, like AI, if this is being manipulated with a bias, we deserve to know. And if we don't know, then we're going to be wrong.
Yep. I actually think the answer ultimately has to be that people have to talk back to Wikipedia. The problem has been that there is whenever you've got a big constituency, I've discovered, you know, that all think the same way. It just is the natural thought of us old, you know, internet website developers, entrepreneurs, whatever, is okay, start a website, get these people organized. But things are so locked down to a great extent that actually starting a significant new voice is really difficult. So I hope that Wiki Critic will serve that purpose. I really do hope, you know, we can get Alex, for example, to write a response to his article on Wikipedia. And I know I've already got a whole bunch of people lined up, basically ready to talk back to Wikipedia, and they can put it on their personal websites. We will just go and grab it, you know, and aggregate it all.
So, you know, okay, we got to go to commercial break here. We'll be back on the other side with Larry Singer. Just how can people find WikiCritic if they want to be involved? Is it possible for them to become beta testers?
It has not been launched yet.
Closed down.
It has not been launched yet. What you were showing on the screen there was just a mock-up.
A preview.
But that gives you, it'll give you a taste.
Okay.
Yeah, LarrySanger.org/WikiCritic.
LarrySanger.org is the URL. We'll be back on the other side with Larry Singer. Don't go anywhere, folks. This is the information war. The front lines, folks. We'll be right back.
Can a microscopic tag be implanted in a person's body to track his every movement? There's actual discussion about that.
And often there are things you don't know what to do with. UBOs, they're called unidentified bright objects.
Can brain scans be used to determine whether a person is inclined toward criminality or violent behavior?
Who's got the brain that's going to be most susceptible to a particular kind of manipulation?
So the point is, they've been obsessed with this. It's going on. The COVID shots implanted the matrix, graphene oxide to grow. It's now being scanned. It's now being read. They were putting chips in the troops 30 years ago. The revolution's already here, is what you're saying, Jesse Beltran.
These are just chips on a size that you can no longer see. They're nano size. One's 2,000 times the width of a human hair. The graphene oxide, the silicon-based materials that have been in, we know for a fact that they were in the mRNA. We know that Dr. Ido Bachelet signed a contract with Pfizer in 2015 when he did that TEDMed talk with a trillion robots in a 1cc syringe, and how he teaches his students how to, once they're in a host, how to control them with RF emissions.
And you heard Collins saying 21 years ago that, oh, yeah, when we're doing scans, we find all these chips, these bright objects, ha, 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 wonder to put them there. But as you said, you've been doing this 20 years, and about 10 years ago, you began to go away not seeing chips anymore, but just liquid emulsion nanotech. Here you are 6 months ago or more scanning me. Let's go to Alex Jones getting scanned.
So if you put that camera in there, you see how it says probably silicone? That means it's an electronic component. And it's not unusual to find that in the posterior ear area.
So wait, I got a higher reading than him?
No, his was higher than yours.
Okay,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, but you did get a positive reading there. So you are getting the you know, base of the neck is what we typically see. Scapula area. What we're finding is after post-COVID, this is very typical. We're completely bombarded by this stuff.
From your own research, there are compounds naturally in nature that just do absolutely incredible things that will draw out these type of things. But you guys have come up with one with scientists that adds these special sea minerals in that then even drags it out even more. And so I have been taking this, the dreams I've had, my skin, my health. What it's done is absolutely insane. Get masterpiece.com. Matt Hazen, tell us what this does, and people can get 10% off when they follow the URL, getmasterpiece.com, or use promo code Alex when you're there on the site, because this is really special.
Zeolite is an incredible mineral that is known as what's called the master binder. And what that means is it's known to pick up every type of forever chemical, toxin, toxic heavy metal there is, including fluoride. So when you see charcoal or carbon or clays for binders, you don't see that they will pick up fluoride. Zeolite's different. Zeolite also gets the fluoride. That's a very big deal. It is great at removing these environmental toxins from our body. Masterpiece is the highest grade sea mineral plasma solution. It is basically isotonic, the same mineral composition as your blood plasma. So the sea minerals are being carried in by the nanometer, sub-nanometer size clinoptilolite zeolite. And once the toxin hits the zeolite, it releases and displaces the mineral. People don't feel bad. There's no normal detoxing reaction.
Everybody needs to go to getmasterpiece.com. You get 10% off by using that URL automatically when you go. There's promo code Alex as well. Getmasterpiece.com.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Alex Jones Show, because there is a war on for your mind.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Alex Jones Show, alexjoneslive.com. Of course, support us by going to the alexjonesstore.com. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, sitting in for Alex Jones today, joined by Larry Sanger. You can go to larrysanger.org to find what he's working on, including things like WikiCritic, the new effort he's made to bring some honesty and truth to Wikipedia. It's severely lacking there these days. Of course, you can follow him on X at L. Sanger. You know, Wikipedia in its digital form is just naturally vulnerable to manipulation, right? I mean, there's something when you print an encyclopedia and it's sitting on the shelf, it ain't changing. That's what it may be wrong, it may be right, but you can go back and reference it. With Wikipedia, you go to an article today, it can be completely different tomorrow, and there's no real alert saying here's what's been changed. And this, of course, leads to things like you can go to, you know, AI destroying books, destroying all these old books and incorporating them into AI. And it's like we're entering into a world where permanence is a thing of the past. Ironically, permanence is a thing of the past. And this just it sort of unmoors us from reality and allows manipulation to be utilized in really egregious ways. How do we contend with that?
There's some technical tools that can be used. At a certain point, in order to distinguish what people say from the confabulations of AI, you actually have to use a digital signature of a person on a piece of content to prove that it is theirs. And we haven't done that enough. And as long as we continue to own our own digital identities, I'm all in favor of that. So that's one of the things that can be done. Now, I'd actually push back a little bit on something that you said about the history of Wikipedia, that Wikipedia does have the entire page history, the whole revision history. And it's fascinating. It's to be honest, actually, I'm a little surprised that they haven't tried to lock it down a little bit more than they have, because it is quite revealing and damning in many cases when you dig into it. But with a lot of articles, you can actually look through the history and you can find all kinds of lines that are not available anymore. They have been oversighted, which is it's a verb. It just means that it's been deleted from the database permanently, apparently. Usually for legal reasons, no doubt, sometimes quite legitimately so. But not always, I think.
And it's not always obvious to the average user. They go, I mean, at least, you know, on some things you'll have a thing saying, oh, this has just been edited. Here's the updated version, you know, on things like X and stuff. But Wikipedia, if you're not really well versed in it, it's hard to find those logs where it changes and to go back through time. So for the average person, it just appears as though this is how it's always been.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And which is very misleading. Now, another technical solution, it's actually not that technical, you can go to justipedia.org, which is a fork of Wikipedia made by a friend of mine, and Buddy Wills, and she has... she's an older lady, but she has more energy than you know, most 20 and 30 year old founders. She's a force of nature, and she's actually managed to create something that's really useful already. And you can freely edit Wikipedia articles so that they are made more neutral on Justipedia, and they're getting quite a bit of traffic. Right. So that's a story that has not been covered. And I wish people did know more about Justipedia. Generally speaking, that's as I think of it, that's part of what I call the encyclosphere, which is basically the collection of all the encyclopedias. Like the blogosphere is not just one blog, it's all the blogs. So the encyclosphere is all the encyclopedias. What we need to do basically is to promote all the alternatives to Wikipedia. And in many cases, you know, if Wikipedia doesn't tell the truth, another one will, you know. There's a lot of information in the world.
And that's what I was getting at with my question in the first segment about, like, is it even worth it to reform Wikipedia, or should we just have another thing? We go, just leave Wikipedia behind. It'll wallow in its own biases all it wants, and we can go create something better. Is it worth it to reform it, or is it better just to try something new?
I would have agreed with you. I did agree with you for a long time. But now, it's come to the point. It's been around for so long. It has not died. You know, the rumors of Wikipedia's death, impending doom, began in like 2007. I remember there was some lawyer who said, by 2009, it won't even exist anymore. And of course, that was wrong. Basically, here's the deal. You can say, let's just ignore it. But here's the problem is, you can ignore it, but it's not going to go away, and it's going to continue to have a lot of influence in the world. You know, Alex Jones viewers may not actually have any use for Wikipedia, I suppose, on average. But a lot of ordinary people still do, right? And, you know,
that's a place where it is. I mean,
we need to take the fight to Wikipedia.
We saw this with social media. I hate to keep bringing up Elon Musk, but it seems like you and he are sort of fighting the same monsters in a lot of different ways. But same thing with that, right? They created Parler and Gab, and there were all these other Truth Social and all these alternatives to X, but X is still the place to be. Or, you know, Twitter at the time, that was the place to be. It was too big to ignore. You couldn't just ignore it. And even if your own thing that you created was successful, it would never really, you know, be a competitor, you know, except when something like TikTok came out and it was so different that it created a whole new category. With Wikipedia, it's not quite that easy. But again, I wonder what the effects of AI are going to be with this. And what is your take on the destroying of the books that places like Anthropic are involved in? Which, again, I want to remind people, the judge, for some reason, the judge decided they could scan the books as long as they destroyed them, which is just insane. You know, they weren't saying we're going to destroy these books because we have to. The judge said, well, it's copyright infringement unless you destroy the book. So now they're buying up every old book they can get, destroying it, and then putting it into AI. And I guess it's, you know, we trust them to say what the contents were. I mean, that seems insane to me. Well, what's your take on that process?
I mean, I have not studied the legal reasoning, but my impression is that they're only supposed to have one copy or something like that, right?
Right.
In their possession.
Yeah.
But of course, the information in those books, which is like the important thing, is going to be in zillions of copies on everybody's, you know, screens.
It makes no sense. It makes no sense at all.
Yes, indeed. I think that this particular case, however, might not be as bad as people think, as long as these companies don't keep doing it. That's for sure. We want it stopped. But generally speaking, there aren't that many books that have so few copies that, you know, it's likely that the last copy was destroyed by the, you know,
consumed consumed by the machines.
Okay.
Well, yes. You know, it's just kind of weird because we're entering into this world where there's so much information. I mean, it's the information age, and yet everybody kind of seems dumber than they ever have been before. And it's, you know, at a certain point, it's like, do the facts even matter? I mean, it's like we can deliver the facts to you, but they don't seem to care. They don't seem to, it doesn't seem to actually affect them. I mean, yeah, book The Dumbest Generation. Tell us about this.
We've been talking about this for a long time, right? You know, I remember buying this book back in like, 2008 or something like that.
We've gotten dumber since then. There you go.
And we've been complaining about that, you know, basically cheap information put into bite-sized chunks, essentially, has taken the place of really understanding whole systems of thought, which are necessary to be able to deal with whole subjects in an intelligent manner.
Right.
I think the problem is because there is so much emphasis on video, on short communications, on quick and easy answers that. I mean, forget about kids, even adults now are finding it harder and harder, or so they say, to read books. You know, I still read a lot of books. I'm reading several books at a time at any given time. That's just me. You know, I'm an ex-academic but I think, you know, the rest of you, got to get it on the ball here.
Seriously,
the the reason why we read books and the reason why books continue to matter, even in an age of AI, is that books provide the sort of logical, meaning-driven scaffolding that we need to think through problems in a systematic way, right? And that is simply not given by ready answers. That just gives you facts. Right. This is an old talking point of teachers and philosophers alike, that essentially knowledge occurs in systems, and you cannot reduce what is learned when you read a book to a set of facts that it contains.
Right.
Right. They actually have to be structured, actually have to go through the thought process that the author went through.
Yeah. You know, I was actually just talking about this earlier in the show before you came on, because I saw this with Anthony Fauci and the Fifth Amendment. I thought people know what the Fifth Amendment is. I mean, you watch crime shows, every, you know, low down criminal, they might not be able to spell their name, but they know they have a right to stay silent. Do they know why? Do they know what the purpose of that is? Why was it, you know, created in the first place, and what it's protecting us from? Because now you've got an agent of the government using the Fifth Amendment to shield his activities in the government. It's like, I think this is all wrong. So you yes. sort of dislocate the idea of the Fifth Amendment from the structure that that actually informs it. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you're completely lost. You don't know why this thing exists or what the value of it is or when it should be used and when it shouldn't. So it's really almost worse than useless. And I see this everywhere. And this is hard. Yeah. We're in a democracy, and we got a bunch of people voting, and they don't even understand the first thing about the reason we have rights and the reason they, you know, how they were created. I think you're exactly right. We need this systematic. I like how you put it. I'm going to have to go back and quote that. The scaffolding, the intellectual scaffolding to understand this stuff is missing now, which is why it's sort of everything's topsy-turvy.
Yep. There's a great example that I can give that sort of links this segment with the previous segment. Most people have no idea what due process is, right, but it's really important. Right. The Fifth Amendment is one of the amendments that actually defines due process. OK, so I'm going to give you a little lecture. Just bear with me. It's actually kind of fun and important. Due process is the set of rights that we have that basically define how we should be treated by the law. All right. So just for example, when we go into a court, there should be a difference between the prosecutor and the judge. The prosecutor shouldn't be the judge, just for example. And that's one of the things that's like required. Another thing is the judge shouldn't have like reasons to be biased, right? If there are things that would make a judge tend to judge the case in one direction rather than another, apart from the bare facts of the case, then, you know, that judge should be out. Now, I'm not going to go through all the rules, but there's a lot of them, you know, and they basically define what impartial justice, a process of impartial justice, looks like. Okay, now here's the thing. On Wikipedia, when I was taken before that administrator's notice board, it was just a mob of people talking about me, right? You know, like bad mouthing me in front of my back and pulling out all kinds, saying all kinds of false things, not being really subject to any rules of decorum, not being answerable to anyone in particular. There was no charges. There were no charges in particular in my case.
Right.
I didn't find out why I could be blocked officially until I actually was blocked in the end. These are the reasons you were blocked. They didn't say that in advance, so I couldn't respond.
Right.
Okay. I was not guaranteed a right to reply. Right. Okay. So what's the point of all this? The point is, if these idiots who staff Wikipedia, the administrators who staff the administrator's notice board, knew why due process rights are important, right? Like if they had worked, if they had been required to work through the answers, well, why is there this rule? Why is there that rule? Then they might actually be open to an argument to the effect that, you know what, this whole process is wrong and it needs to be reformed. And I actually told them that when the process was going on. And they said, this is not a courtroom. Well, obviously, it's not a courtroom.
Right. But if they're leveling punishments, I mean, you know, it, there should be. And, you know, I think back to the, you know, after January 6th, they had basically a show trial. And I remember being outraged going, they're making accusations, but not giving the accused a right to reply. This is in total violation of our, you know, fundamental beliefs about what is fair in justice. So, I mean, you're seeing it obviously on the internet. I mean, people can make up the rules they want, but even in our politics, you know, you have things that are functionally, they look like courtrooms, they act like courtrooms. There's a guy with a hammer in it, but it's not a courtroom. It's something else. And people can't recognize that for some reason.
Right. They have to be made to read books probably when they're young that explain all of these things and actually work through all the issues. So it's kind of hard, you know, and certainly the leaders of society have to understand these things in their bones. It has to actually be part of a common education, not just some specialists.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I've got, you know, in the last hour of the show, I'm going to play a lot of videos from some of the new socialist mayors that are coming up. And you know, whether it's Mamdani or this woman in Seattle, or there's a woman running for governor of Michigan, I believe now. And it's like these people, they have no experience. They think just because they sort of can put things in a clever way that means they're right. What I'm trying to get at is there is a lack of respect for like older generations that I see everywhere. And to me, that's what provides part of the ability of these people to justify why they don't care about this stuff. They go, well, those are just old guys. They're old fusty guys, white supremacists, whatever. Why should we even care what they have to say? Which leads you to totally misunderstanding what the policies they were putting in place are, or why they were putting them into place. It has a lot to do, I think, with this lack of humility, I guess, at the end of the day, that especially young people have now, where they genuinely think they know everything. Even when I was young, I at least, you know, I thought, well, I think my grandpa's wrong about this, but he's my grandpa and he's been around for 80 years. So I'm going to go with him on this one. There's no humility now. And that's celebrated, I guess, to this lack of humility.
Yes,
it's rewarded.
I think this is like the common complaint of old people talking about young people going back to ancient days, right? But nevertheless, I think it's especially true now, and there's a very good reason for that. And it is that basically beginning in, I would say, the 1990s, maybe the 2000s, and really ramping up in the last decade, basically, if you get a degree in anything other than hard, technology or science, anything other than STEM, you are going to be indoctrinated to death in college. And so the leaders of society have been indoctrinated, the young ones. And they have a radically different worldview than the traditional American view. They simply don't understand the traditional American view. There's a whole lot of information there that they just don't have. They have a very poor grasp on, for example, the contents of the Federalist Papers, just for example. They probably have never actually read the Constitution, you know, most your average college graduate. So I actually think that the problem is kind of a generation gap that is due to the younger generations who are now actually starting to come into power being totally radicalized by their education. That bit is kind of scary, but not all of them. I would hasten to add, not all of them.
No, yeah, certainly not all of them. And I was going to say, I guess I'm officially old now, but I think I've always been old. 'Cause I remember being a kid and, you know, these people were like, well, you know, these stupid sheep herders. I'm like, have you read the Psalms? Like, do you know what you're talking about? Like, these people are not stupid. And the arrogance of young people of thinking, well, some scientist somewhere knows how lightning works, therefore God's not real. And it's like, this is absurd. But We're sort of seeing the outcome of this with some of these people being elected, and it's not going well. But we don't have too much longer with you, and I this has been incredibly informative, but I want people to, yeah, here you go, literal self-admitted communists are all over the Democratic Party now. I was going to add, I have a clip from Bill Maher, and I was going to, do you want to talk about him real quick? But really, I want people to be able to help you in your mission and contribute. This is what it's all about, right? So other than being informed, how can people help you and contribute to what you're doing, and whether in their own personal life by, you know, making changes to Wikipedia or whatever it is, or contributions, how can people help you achieve your goals?
So I would say, first of all, follow me on X, L Sanger. That'd be cool. If you have an old account on Wikipedia that you haven't used in a long time, you haven't been banned, then there is a special way to use it. You really need to be very careful about not breaking the rules. But if you're really serious about making a difference in pushing Wikipedia in another direction, that the fact of the matter is there are not that many people working on Wikipedia any given month. It's a lot fewer than what people assume it is. There are a lot of drive-by edits, yes, of course, because it gets a lot of traffic. But those are just drive-by edits. The actual number of people who are working to any a great extent is probably in the hundreds, right? If you were to, you know, get enough people on Wikipedia making reasonable edits and then occasionally making progress in other directions, that can make a big difference. It doesn't actually take that many. So that's one thing. Another thing is I would encourage people, if they've got X accounts or blogs, Substacks, or even just a Google Doc, right? Write a review of a Wikipedia article, right? And then send it to me. I've posted it, a thread about this on X recently. So go to L Sanger on X and just post a link to your review underneath that. I will give you early access to WikiCritic. So that'd be great. I need more beta testers, and I want to go, you know, launch with a bang. So that would be awesome.
Oh, that would be great. And you know, people are always... The question I probably get most is like, what can I do? What I want to be involved. And it's like, well, here you go, folks. This is how you can be involved. You can do it from the comfort of your computer chair, or, you know, probably on your phone. This is a way you can actually, and hey, you might not feel like you as an individual are able to take on this whole, gigantic array of misinformation ours, but if you and your friend and your family, and if we all get involved, then, you know, we overwhelm them with numbers, but it takes us actually getting active. Incredible stuff. Larry Sanger, thank you so much for being with us. LarrySanger.org and at L Sanger on X. Thank you so much. You created such a powerful tool, and it's why it's being attacked. They recognize how powerful this is, but we can be more powerful still. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Don't go anywhere.
Jones is off the air.
There's a lot of noise right now.
Taking me off the air. It is beyond essential that you continue to spread the word about the broadcast and continue to support us.
That's usually when it matters most, to have people in your corner who don't flinch. We've been a partner of this program and of Alex's for a long time.
I'm handing out ice water in the Sahara. I mean, it is such the top rated, the biggest company, because they're the best. And he's a patriot.
We're not going anywhere, and that commitment runs to you. Here's the part that matters. With us, it's 8% when you buy and 0% when you sell. And here's something else. After you make your first purchase and become a client, if you're holding metals you bought somewhere else, bring them to us. We'll help you liquidate them. No commission. That means even if you didn't originally buy them from us, we'll still take care of you. That's not a promotion. It's not something that's for a limited time only. That's just the way we do business. Give us a call and we'll bend over backwards to help you.
Visit kepm.com/gold to get started, or give us a call at 720-605-3900 and let us help you make room for what matters most.
Spot price of the metal in the ground. Manufacturers, miners haven't even touched it yet. Then they pull the metal out of the ground, they dig their tunnels, they drive it to the refinery, they melt it down, make it into a coin or a bar. That's wholesale. That's usually 3-5% over spot. We charge 8% on top of wholesale. When you liquidate, we charge zero.
Buy gold and silver bullion, at wholesale. You can look every day what the price is, type in what's wholesale gold and silver, and then you get it from them with a little processing fee, and then they buy it back for nothing with no cost. That's unprecedented. It's so easy. KPM.com/gold. Get a free telephone consultation email. You call 720-605-3900, 720-605-3900.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.